Hey, everyone, and welcome to Movie Crush. This is Charles W. Chuck Bryant, by day, co-host of Stuff You Should Know, and by night, well, this is during the day, too. Let's be serious. But this is Movie Crush, the show where I sit down and talk to awesome people about their all-time favorite movies. And this week in the studio, we have Mr. John Ronson. He is a writer of screenplays at times. He is an author of books. He wrote the great book, The Psychopath Test. He wrote the great book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. That's a really good one. They're both terrific. But if you have any interest in sort of this weird modern thing we have where people are publicly humiliated in the internet age and their lives can be ruined, then you really need to read So You've Been Publicly Shamed. It's fantastic. John, like I said, has also written some screenplays. He wrote the book that the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats was based on. And he also just recently on released on Netflix is a great new movie called Okja, O-K-J-A, that you're going to hear John talk about. And he wrote the script for that. And really, he's just sort of a jack of all trades. The movie Frank that we're going to talk about a little bit, I hope, is something that John wrote. Really, really cool movie with Michael Fassbender. If you haven't seen it, highly recommend that as well. John is just an all-around good guy. We were lucky enough to have him at a Stuff You Should Know live show, one of our variety shows where we have kind of different folks doing different things in Brooklyn, New York at the Bell House. And John got up on stage and did a great reading. And it's just a lovely, lovely sweetheart of a man. And I really can't say thanks enough to him for being on Movie Crush. And this week we're going to talk about Let the Right One In, which is John's all-time favorite movie. And he did not, he's one of these that did not seem to deliberate much about this. I think he kind of knew what his favorite movie was. He's said it before publicly, and he'll say it again, I'm sure. So Let the Right One In is a really great movie. It is a foreign film. It's a Swedish romantic horror film. It's how it's officially described. It was directed by Thomas Alfredson, and it is based on a novel from 2004, and it is the story of a young boy who is sort of bullied in school, and he makes the acquaintance of a young girl in his little apartment complex. They meet on the playground, and it turns out that she is a vampire, and she ends up serving as his protector in the film and sort of avenging the bullies that come after this kid. So at its heart, and then John and I talk about this in the interview, but it is very much a romantic sort of coming-of-age love story sort of couched in this grisly Swedish vampire thing. So really, really good film. If you haven't checked it out, or the remake, the American remake, which is called Let Me In, which was also a really good movie. It's one of the few times that an American remake, I think, is done right by the original material. But I say see them both. Definitely see Let the Right One In if you haven't. It's from 2008, rated R, and just very stark, moody, atmospheric tale told well. So without any further ado, here's John Ronson and Let the Right One In. But you grew up in Wales. Is
yes,
that right?
I grew up in Cardiff in Wales. And most of my earliest childhood memories, or in fact, throughout my childhood, my memories are my best memories of movies. So one of my very earliest memories was watching Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in my parents' bed, which...
Oh, nice.
Yeah, which I think was kind of inappropriate, actually, because the ending of that movie is devastating, and it haunted me.
Yeah.
Because you...
How old were you?
Probably 4 or 5.
Oh, wow.
And you're watching people, you know, the movie freeze frames at the moment of their death. And that was haunting for me. And then as I got older, there was this arts centre in Cardiff. It's still there, called Chapter Arts Centre. And it was the only place in Cardiff that would show, you know, interesting independent films and have interesting, you know, bands and so on. So when I was like 13 or 14, I'd go to Chapter, and I remember I saw a double bill of Zelig and the King of Comedy, which had a big impact on me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not that either of those movies are like, I mean, they're both great movies, but I wouldn't say either of them are amazing movies. But still, it gave me a very strong feeling that there was a life beyond Cardiff that I could strive for.
I was kind of curious, because when I was a kid, I didn't have the sense that, I don't think I had an understanding that movies were made by people and craftsmen and artists until I was much older. So no. did you know from an early age that, like, people write these and they act in these and they put them together, a director does? Like, did you understand that?
Yeah. When I was very young, I remember going to my grandparents' house. My grandparents lived in a really big house in Cardiff. It had its own indoor pond. And they would listen, like my parents and my grandparents would listen to Woody Allen records. And just laugh and laugh, you know, the moose sketch. Was it a moose with the costume party?
I don't remember.
That they run over
from his stand-up.
Yeah, they're driving and they run over a moose, and then they strap the moose to the front of the car, and then they need to get rid of the moose, and then the moose comes back to life. Do you not know this sketch?
Yeah,
and then
I don't think I heard that one.
So now they have like a living moose, and so they take it to a costume party and pretend it's a couple in a moose outfit. And that's their way of... Anyway, I remember listening to this and just screaming with laughter, and my parents and grandparents screaming with laughter. And then later on, I would see, you know, every Woody Allen movie that came out, I'd see Annie Hall, or I saw Manhattan, and then, you know, Zelig and Broadway Danny Rose, and knowing that Woody Allen was like an auteur. So I think I understood about the craft of film because I was so interested in Woody Allen as a kind of, you know, crafts person.
Right. That's pretty interesting. I wish I would have had that because, well, in a way, though, I kind of was fooled into this, like, magic of these movies just existing for a while. But conversely, you know, I had an interest in writing movies later on, and I think it would have been nice to know earlier on that that's a thing that you can do for a job.
Right.
You know?
Yes. I remember thinking that movie stars were, you know, impossibly non-human. You know, seeing those, like, I remember thinking, like, if I ever met a movie star, I just don't know what I would do. Because they were just...
Who was the first movie star you met?
George Clooney, maybe. I must have met people before him. He was in the movie adaptation of one of my books. So I spent, like, a bit of time with him. Like, the first movie star I ever spent some time with was George Clooney. But I must have met movie stars before that. I must have.
I mean, the whole cast of that movie was great. I mean, you had a pretty great first experience with an adaptation.
Yeah, amazing.
I would think, right?
Yeah, I have only happy memories. I think that film, the film's The Men Who Stare at Goats, and I've noticed over the years that the film divides people. Some people really love it, and some people don't like it at all. But I'm in the really love it camp.
Me too.
Thank you. And so is Peter Strawn, who wrote the screenplay for my book. I mean, in fact, a couple of years ago, I was curating a film festival in England in this town called Bridport. And we showed The Men Who Stare at Goats, and me and Peter sat through it and watched it for the first time in years. And at the end of the film, we both sort of turned to each other and kind of, you know, nodded like it's still good. It's a good film. Yeah.
And then, that's a good feeling.
Yeah. And in fact, it was Peter who convinced me to try and write screenplays myself. So me and him then wrote the movie Frank with Michael Fassbender in it. And then on the back of Frank, I got to co-write this new film, Okja, which is just out on Netflix. So now I've been involved in a few films. Yeah.
No, what's that one? What's that new one?
Okja. It's a film directed by Bong Joon-ho. It's just come out on Netflix, and it's about a girl and her best friend is a giant pig the size of an elephant, and then the pig gets kidnapped by Tilda Swinton and taken to New York, and Meja, the girl, has to get her pig back before it ends up in the slaughterhouse.
Okja. Wow. Was this your original idea? Or?
No, it's Bong Joon-ho's original idea, and he brought me on to co-write it from the second draft onwards. If I may make so bold, it's good. It's a good film. Yeah. and a lot of people like it. It's a good film that's liked. It has a very sort of haunting ending, and lots of people find themselves sobbing uncontrollably when the film ends, and then they film themselves sobbing uncontrollably and then post the film on Twitter or Instagram. So I've seen a lot of people crying because of our film.
Well, I'm going to watch that tonight.
Yeah, Okja.
And I'm not just saying
that. It's
okay,
a, it's a, yeah, it's a good film. It's a very good film.
Well, I think one thing I've always appreciated about, I mean, not only your books, but Men Who Stare at Goats and Frank, is just your purview on life is always slightly left of center, which is something
Okja.
I've always been drawn to. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, just from the description, it sounds pretty interesting.
It is.
But Frank, how did Frank come about, aside from that sort of being not your life story, but at least a portion of it was true to you?
Yeah. When Peter Strawn was writing the screenplay of The Men Who Stare at Goats, I wrote a piece in The Guardian about my years when I was just in my early 20s playing keyboards for this band in Manchester called the Frank Sidebottom Band, and the singer wore a big fake head that he never took off. So I wrote this little memoir in The Guardian about it, because the singer, Chris, who was underneath the fake head, was staging a comeback and he wanted some help, so he asked me to write something. So Peter called me up after the piece appeared and said that he had always wanted to write a fictional music biopic. He always had this idea, he said, like, what if Captain Beefheart had been around in the 50s?
Right.
So, but then he said, but your idea is better. But I didn't have an idea, so I didn't really know what he was talking about. But I suppose what he was talking about was, what if we write a film where the lead singer wears a big fake head that he never takes off?
So was it fictionalized then?
Yeah.
For the most part?
Yeah. I mean, some of it was true. The way that the character John, based on me, joins the band was very true to life, about just sort of happening on this group and getting to join us in a very kind of Alice Through the Looking Glass way. But then we bought a bunch of other, we sort of made a fictional, I guess Frank at its heart is like a sort of fictional mashup of a bunch of different stories about outsider musicians. So there was our Frank, which was Frank Sidebottom with the head. And then a lot of the film was inspired by Daniel Johnston. Do you know him?
Big fan of his.
Yeah, he's wonderful. Bipolar singer-songwriter whose life has been a sort of battle between his, I guess, his talent and his disorder. There's an amazing documentary, probably my favourite documentary I've ever seen, was made about Daniel Johnston called The Devil and Daniel Johnston.
I've seen it. It's really, like, amazing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Just one of the best ones I've seen in a long time. I think I saw it when it was out in the theatre, actually.
The Devil and Daniel Johnston is the best documentary I've ever seen about mental health, and it's probably the best documentary I've ever seen.
And he really, I think I saw that and Marwin Call within the same, like, 6 or 8 months.
Right.
Did you ever see that documentary?
No, but I've met the guy.
Really?
Yeah, I've been to his house and I've hung out with him.
Oh, my God.
Bit. Yeah, you should explain what Marwin Call is, because people won't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have seen it by now, but it's, what was his name or what is his name?
Been to his house as well. His name is is Mark Hogenkamp. And he woke right. up one day, Mark Hogenkamp. I know I asked you to tell the story, but I tell it in an especially good way, so will I tell it?
Okay.
It's because I wrote about him, so I had to work out the best way of telling his story. So he woke up one day in an unfamiliar room, and there was a man standing. He was in pain, so he knew something had happened. And the man standing at the end of his bed said, do you know where you are? And he said, yeah, I'm in Ibiza, and it's 1984. And the man said, no, you're in upstate New York, and the year is 2000. And a few days ago, some men almost beat you to death. And the first thing he said was, I forgive them. And the man at the end of his bed said, you wouldn't forgive them if you knew what they did to you. So they gave him brain damage because he was trans. And so they beat him up. Anyway, part of his way of recovering from this was to create this world in his garden of this incredibly elaborate world set in World War II. And it's called Mauwinkel. And it's all done with like Barbie dolls. And he's, you know, creates this sort of empire. And it's him reenacting his beating, but getting revenge on the people who did it by killing them in all these kind of horrendous ways. So I wrote about him, and there was that documentary made about him. And now I believe there's going to be a movie about him made by the guy who did Forrest Gump, maybe?
Zemeckis, Robert Zemeckis?
Yeah, Robert Zemeckis. Zemeckis is making a movie about him, which is half set in his actual life and half set in the fictional world that he created.
Does that worry you?
No, it'd be good. I think it might worry him.
You think?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think when you... I don't know. I think I'm one of those people that thinks when you make a documentary that so completely nails it that you can only mess things up by trying to, you know, get although like you put Michael Fassbender in a giant head. So what? who am I talking to here?
And not only that, but I had Tilda Swinton kidnapping a giant pig in Oakja.
Right.
I tell you what slightly worries me is that I think the best movie that could possibly be made about somebody's inner life, where you kind of recreate their actual life and then their fantasy world, has already been made, and it was Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures.
Oh, God, what a great movie.
Yeah, it links, I think, to Let the Right One In. I've noticed over the years that all the things I love the most are in some way related to a kind of dysfunctional childhood friendship. That for some reason, that moves me more than anything else. And that's what Heavenly Creatures is about. And that's what the movie I've chosen for you is about too.
So with Let the Right One In, were you had you read the book previously or have you since?
No, I started reading the book since and liked it very much, but I think my attention wandered and I never got back into it. But I liked what I read.
Yeah, because there were I mean, I saw the movie when it came out on it was Netflix. So after the theatrical release, and this is sort of in that, I think Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was about a year after that. So my wife and I, Emily and I, were watching these, you know, Swedish films thinking like, where have we been? Like, why is every Swedish movie coming out amazing? Mm. And just rewatched Let the Right One In today,
like
minutes before I came in. Oh yeah. I mean, it's an amazing movie, and just, I'm kind of curious, what was your first experience seeing it?
Well, I think that does relate to the fact that it's my favorite movie, like the way that I got to see it. I remember my wife and son were away somewhere. So I was alone in our house in London. And it was on at the Barbican, which is this, you know, amazing. I don't, have you ever been to London and the Barbican?
I haven't been to the Barbican, but I've been to London a few times.
Right. So I guess, but I mean, I live in New York now, and I guess the Barbican is probably the closest to Lincoln Center in New York. It's this big center in East London. It's very kind of brutalist. It was made in the 60s, so it looks incredible. It looks like a kind of, you know, like you're inside a J.G. Ballard book, kind of brutalist, right, and quite harsh. But it's amazing. It's an amazing place. Anyway, so, but it's quite austere. So I was in the Barbican. I was on my own. My wife and son were away. I didn't know anything about the film. And I do think, you know, every film benefits from you not knowing anything about it. Like, nobody, I think, writes a screenplay thinking that anybody should watch this film other than going into it with no knowledge at all. But very few people do, right? I mean, you pretty much every film you see, you know a little bit, you know something about the film before you go in, which is a shame, right? Because that's because no movie person wants a film to be watched that way.
Yeah, sure. It's with any kind of preconceived thoughts.
Yeah, you know a little bit about the plot. You know something. You know, you really want to see a film where you know nothing, and it's such a privilege when you see a film that way. And that was the way I saw Let the Right One In, and it's a perfect film to see that way because you don't even know for the first 20 minutes of the film, you don't even know what genre it is. You don't know what you're watching. And then very slowly the kind of genre of the film unveils itself to you, which is the first great thing about the film. Anyway, people sometimes talk about a piece of art like screwing them up, like getting inside their psyche and mangling it. Like, you know, you've heard people say that about things, right?
Sure.
Yeah. It had never happened to me. Like, I'd never seen a film that really, if I can swear for a moment.
We're fine.
Okay, that really kind of fucked with me.
Right.
But Let the Right One In did. I watched it, and I walked back from the Barbican to my house alone, and I lay in bed, and I thought, that film's really fucked with me. It impacted my mental health in a way that stuff never does. And I think I know why.
Yeah, well, I know what you...
Go on.
Well, why is that?
Well,
No. I want to hear why.
Okay, because I think it was prodding at a sort of very deep sort of psychology of mine. Because what's the film, you know, really about? It's about a kid at school being bullied and a beautiful girl comes along and kills the bullies on his behalf.
Yeah.
It's like the inverse of a kind of White Knight movie, right? Because it's a girl saving a boy. So...
Yeah.
So I think it kind of just prodded at stuff that, like a deep well of weird psychology that was going on inside of my head.
Yeah, I think... Well, one of my favorite things in movies is when bullies get their comeuppance. Mm. And like you were talking about before with you don't even know what genre it is. I don't even think you fully understand that until after it's over. Because at first, you know, the first kill that happens with her caretaker, you think before you even know that he's a caretaker, you think, oh, all right, well, this is a serial killer movie.
Right.
But there was something about the workmanlike way he went about that first kill that just made it slightly off to where you know, like, there's something else going on here.
Yeah.
He's collecting blood as if it is his job.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
You know?
And he looks like he's not having a great time doing it. He's a bit forlorn.
Yeah.
Like, ugh, here we go again.
Right. And that's the case. You know, as the movie unfolds, that's exactly what's going on. Mm. And I liked how the movie didn't really explain why it leaves it open to an interpretation why this guy was doing it. And my thought was that perhaps he had met and fallen in love with Ellie when he was 12 years old.
Yes.
And this is him just sort of paying it forward. But
yeah.
And I hope this doesn't ruin anything, but I did look up bits of the book. And do you know what his deal was?
Apparently in the book, he's a pedophile.
Right.
Yes.
Which they don't allude to in the movie, and I'm glad they didn't.
I'm glad
because
they
once
didn't.
I found that out, it wasn't as I didn't like that turn.
No.
Yeah, for real.
Well, especially because the end of the movie is so bittersweet and so haunting, because you we're talking about this and assuming that anybody listening to this doesn't mind like total spoilers.
Spoilers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of the case with all these.
Okay. Because so at the end of the film, you're all at once seeing Oscar at a moment of total happiness. He's the bullies are dead. He's got the girl. They're going to go off for a fantastic new life together. It's at a moment of perfect, infinite happiness. But you also know at the same time, you know, Oscar's going to grow up and have to do all the same shit for Ellie, who's going to stay exactly the same age as her old caretaker did. And
yeah,
it's not going to be a good life for him.
Yeah, I think that was definitely something I wanted to ask you, if you got that same feeling, which is now that kind of very, like you said, bittersweet, very sadly, he's almost doomed to a life now.
Doomed to a terrible life, which will end just as awfully as her old caretaker's life ends.
Boy, which that was a bad ending for him.
But it's not her fault. That's the other thing. It's not like Ellie's a bad person. She's not. You know, she's stuck in this situation too. So you can't blame her.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of sympathy for that character, and the girl who played her, her name's Lena Leanderson.
Mm-hmm.
She really, like, I don't know what the casting process is like, but they really managed to get a girl who could play somebody who felt, who had the weight of 200 years on her shoulders.
Yes, but did you know that Thomas Alfredson employed a trick to make it feel even more that way? Which was the fact that the actual actress, Lena, did you say her name was?
Yeah.
He redubbed her voice throughout the entire movie because her voice was, you know, young and high and childlike. And it didn't feel right. So he got a mature woman to revoice her. Yeah, isn't that smart?
I did not know that. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope that's not fake news. I hope I've given you true information. That's certainly what I believe is the case.
That makes sense because her voice did seem a little out of body, even though it worked. And they also had a couple of the shots where he showed the old, not a 200-year-old version, but an adult version of her.
Yes. That's right. There's only a couple of bits of CGI in that film. It's used incredibly sparingly, but very effectively.
Yeah, and I mean, just living proof that you can make a movie dealing with supernatural elements and not weigh it down with a bunch of fake shit.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that movie's great, not because it's a vampire movie or a horror movie. It's great because it's a love story, right? I mean, isn't that what people like the most
absolutely.
About that film? Yeah. I remember I met Thomas Alfredson once or twice, and I remember him saying to me, you know, it's not a vampire movie. Like, I think he'd been annoyed that somebody had called it a vampire movie. He's like, of course it's not a vampire movie. And of course it's not.
No, it's a romance.
Yeah, it's a romance, and
it's a movie about young love.
Yeah, and about bullying. It's about young love and bullying.
Yeah, and I think he helps his case out too by not, it wasn't laden with vampire mythology, with, you know, garlic and wooden stakes and all that stuff. Like, I think literally the only piece of mythology was from the title, was him in that one scene inviting her in.
Yes, and then all the blood comes from her eyes and ears.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to invite me in. Yeah. It's really... So I think the reason why I was so, you know, moved by that film and it kind of affected me so powerfully is because, you know, I guess, you know, I, like many people, you know, I was Oscar dreaming of an Ellie. In by the way, a town right. that wasn't hugely unlike. I mean, the kind of environment I grew up in wasn't hugely unlike the environment that Oscar grows up in.
Uh-huh.
You know, kind of Northern European, you know, pretty right. cold sort of. I mean, I lived in a pretty nice part of town, but it was a pretty, you know, working class town.
So, yeah, I think the setting of that movie is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I really recognized myself in Oscar. You know, the kind of school that I went to was kind of like Oscar's school. The experience that Oscar had was sort of similar to the experience that I had. And the only, you know, the main difference between me and Oscar was that I dreamed of someone like Ellie coming into my life to, you know, fall in love with and to kill the bullies. Right. And it actually did happen to Oscar. So it's a kind of profound wish fulfillment film.
Very cathartic, I imagine, watching that final pool scene.
Yeah, though not cathartic, more sort of emotionally damaging, I'd say.
Just sort
of,
oh, really?
Yeah, it just sort of brought all the old... I think as I lay there in bed that night, it just brought all the old wounds to the surface. I'd say the opposite
man.
Of cathartic. I wish it had been cathartic.
I figured you would charge out of the theater, you know, like on a high.
Yes, so like at the end of Trainspotting or Slumdog Millionaire, like bouncing down the street.
Right,
no,
exactly.
No, I walked out of that cinema with my head low and feeling upset.
Oh, no.
Yes.
I'm sorry you're having to talk about it.
No, it's fine. I mean, since then, you know, George Clooney was in one of my films. That's right. My Ellie.
Well, speaking of the pool scene, though, it was one thing that occurred to me when I was watching it was just how, like, without the CGI and all the overburdened effects and things that he didn't use, some of the most, like, disturbing images I've seen in movies came from this movie.
That pool just scene out of, in particular.
Oh, yeah, just out of sheer creativity. Like, instead of having some huge, gory fight at the end, it's all from that underwater perspective, and you see that kid being yanked through the water, and immediately you know that arm is fucking going to float down at some point, not attached to a body.
Yeah, I know. Amazing.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, so, you can feel it. It's going to happen.
Yeah, so beautifully directed. He's really amazing, Thomas Alfredson, right?
Yeah, what else did he did Tinker Tailor?
Yeah, which my friend Peter wrote by coincidence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Peter Strawn, who I wrote Frank with, wrote Tinker Tailor, the screenplay, obviously. And in fact, he's just written Thomas Alfredson's next film, which is the sequel to Tinker Tailor, Smiley's People.
Oh, great.
So they've been working together ever since. Thomas Alfredson came to the premiere of The Men Who Stare at Goats, and I... saw him and I went up to him and I said, you know, I want you to know that Let the Right One In is my favourite film ever. And he looked very moved and said, thank you. And then Edgar Wright walked over to us and said to Thomas Alfredson, I want you to know that Let the Right One In is my favourite film of the last 6 months. And I said, I just told him it's my favourite film ever.
Right. He's like, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I just saw Baby Driver a couple of days ago, actually.
That's really good, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah. Yeah. I saw it with my son. You know, it came out the very same day. I'm sorry to keep bringing up Okja, but it came out the same day as Okja. And weirdly, both films contain the same unusual line of dialogue, which is everything but the squeal. So what, you know,
oh, really?
What a coincidence that these two films would come out the same day with both containing the line, everything but the squeal.
Well, and interestingly, Let the Right One In, the first lines in the movie are about the squeal.
That's right. That's right. They're making
because
Oscar,
she references at the end.
Yeah, squealing. That's right. Which that's probably, is that a reference to...
Deliverance?
No, I was going to say, I mean, there's a bit of Deliverance in there, but I was going to say Lord of the Flies. Because don't they make...
Piggy?
Piggy, yeah.
Yeah, of course. I think being... maybe it's because I'm a middle-aged American man, I hear squeal like a pig, and all I can think about is Ned Beatty being right. sodomized in the forest.
Right. You see, when I have
Deliverance.
Right. When I hear squeal like a pig, I think of, or everything but the squeal, I think of the meat industry, which is what Ogja is in part about. Because there's a phrase in the pork industry that like the amazing thing about pigs is that they're all, it's all edible, everything but the squeal. So I stole that line for Ogja, and Edgar stole that line for Baby Driver. It's all edible.
That's fantastic.
The squeal. Yeah.
Well, maybe some more people will insert that line over the years, and that'll just be kind of one of those, like the Wilhelm scream.
Oh, yeah, the Wilhelm scream. Like, yeah.
It'll just be in like 100 movies one day.
Right. Yeah, it's a savage line.
Did you see the remake?
No.
Let me in?
No, I had, even though I like Chloe Grace Moretz, you know, I'm a fan of hers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I loved her in Kick-Ass. And so I felt she was a perfect person to play Ellie. But, you know, I love Let the Right One In so much. I know I would have only felt annoyance and disappointment at the remake. Did you see the remake?
I did. And I think that's a pretty, not brave, but morally righteous choice to not see something like that. Because it was a good movie. And it was one of the few times that I saw a remake of a foreign film that I was in, I don't know about in favor, because it's always a little bit weird when people do that. But I was like, this is really good. Like, they did right by it, did a good job.
Okay,
so,
that's
so
good.
I don't think you should see it. Yeah, I'm not recommending you see it. Uh-huh. But you should feel good knowing that they did a good job. They didn't make it some, like, shitty American kind of over-the-top thing. They were really true to the source material.
Speaking of which, my son told me a couple of days ago that he just saw the Nicolas Cage remake of The Wicker Man and was telling me some lines from it, and it sounded unbelievable. The bee, he said, like, is there a line when Nicolas Cage is yelling, you know, the bees are in my eyes.
I didn't see it.
And that was like his version of... The Wicker Man, by the way, is another one of my favourite films of all time, the original.
Oh, yeah, the original?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great movie. I saw that when I was in college. I went through... I worked at a kind of the best video store in Athens, Georgia, mm-hmm. for a couple of years. And, you know, that time when you're in college, when you start really getting into independent film and cult films, and that was when my eyes were kind of really cinematically open. Uh-huh. And I remember seeing The Wicker Man in college and probably over several joints with friends. And my mind was kind of blown. I was like, man, this is one of the most unsettling movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible to think that it was made almost as like an afterthought, like B movie for Don't Look Now, right? That's how it first came out. It's like in a double bill of Don't Look Now as the lesser of the two films. Yeah.
How interesting.
And I think it took a little while, and then some of it got lost, and they found some of it in some concrete in like a bridge. Like, some of it got buried as landfill. And so finally they sort of, you know, managed to piece it back together. But it wasn't a respected film at all at the time. You know, its reputation just grew years later.
All right, so we will end with a couple of little segments here that I've cooked up.
Sure.
One of them is called What Ebert Said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Because Roger Ebert was my favorite film critic of all time, and I'm always curious to go back in retrospect and see what he said about some of these movies.
Right.
And you'll be delighted to know that he gave Let the Right One In 3.5 stars out of 4.
Hmm. What did he lose half the star for? There's only one flaw in that film. There's only one mistake in that film. And you know what it is,
right? Oh, what's that?
Oh, it's the cats.
The crotch shot?
No, the cats.
Oh, that was a great scene. What are you talking about?
I don't like that scene. I think it's the one, because it's slapstick, and the film, you know, I felt that that moment of slapstick ruined the, you know, the tone, the otherwise sort of melancholy tone of the film. But maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, that interesting slapstick, because I didn't I think sometimes did people laugh in the theater when that happened?
I think there was a bit of awkward laughter. Surely a woman running around completely covered by cats.
See, I found it disturbing. That was one of the most like disturbing shots in the movie to me is but it's funny, I can see being at a theater full of people, and once a couple of people laugh at something, then it creeps into your head.
Right.
Yeah. I can see that now.
So what did he take half a star off for?
He doesn't really explain what he didn't like about it. Are you just saying, why didn't he call it a perfect movie?
Yeah. If it wasn't the cats.
Well, here was a pull quote. Remove the vampire elements, and this is the story of two lonely and desperate kids capable of performing dark deeds without apparent emotion. Kids washed up on the shores of despair. The young actors are powerful in draining roles. We care for them more than they care for themselves. So that's what Ebert said.
Yeah. I never thought that, I mean, it's a great line, but I disagree with one bit of it, I think, which he says that they can perpetrate acts of violence without, he's almost sort of alluding to them being kind of psychopathic, like they do it without emotion. But I don't...
Yeah, I didn't agree with that part either.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of emotion in those two characters.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a weird review, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Swedes tend to keep it all in. So maybe he just wasn't used to the keeping it all in of the Swedes.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess, although I don't think in the American version they overdid it. But yeah, maybe he was looking for, you know, more outward emotion.
Yeah. Other than that, I really like what he said, because it's true. It's what we said too, right?
Yeah, I think so. All right. So let's finish with this then. It's a little, it's kind of a new thing I'm going to try, and it's, and these could be quick answers, but it's five questions.
Okay.
Kind of just about your general film fandom.
Okay.
What's the first movie you remember seeing in the movie theater?
In the movie theater, I remember seeing 2001: A Space Odyssey and sleeping all the way through it.
Good answer.
Yeah. Oh, apparently I saw Bambi, and I've been told, and when Bambi's looking for his mother, I apparently ran down the aisle and yelled at the screen, "Your mother's dead." Apparently. I have no memory of that.
Oh, that's fantastic. My wife still can't watch any of those Disney films now because she was so scarred by Bambi. She was like, someone dies in every one of them. Yeah. I can't do it.
God, just wait till she sees Okja.
Well, she's out of town, so I'm going to watch it tonight while she's gone.
Okay.
What was your first R-rated movie that you saw?
Well, where I came from, it was there was no R. It was X, or double A. Double A meant 15 and above, and X meant 18 and above.
All right. So, I guess what was the first X?
The first X I saw, it might have been, if it was an X, it might have been Rollerball. Do you remember Rollerball?
Oh yeah, James Caan.
Yeah.
Wasn't that?
It could have been Rollerball. I remember there was a bunch of films I saw all at once, like when I was probably about 14 or 15. There was Rollerball. There was Death Race 2000. There was probably The Warriors and The Wanderers. Both of those films came out all at the same time. I'd say my first X film would have been one of those films.
Okay. Yeah. Question three. Do you walk out of a bad movie if it's bad enough? And if so, what was the last movie you walked out on?
I almost never walk out of bad movies, but I have done once or twice. There was one movie, I can't remember the name of it, but it was just so misogynistic. It was something to do with like a wedding or a bachelor party. Maybe it was Bachelor Party. Was there a movie called Bachelor Party?
Oh yeah, Tom Hanks.
I think
Tom Hanks.
I think I walked out of Bachelor Party because of its misogyny. I've got a memory of that.
Nice.
I remember being in Nantucket on vacation, and we went to see Event Horizon, And I didn't walk yes. out, but halfway through the film, somebody walked out and yelled at the audience, "If you are, if you have had any self-respect, you'd walk out too." By the way, going back briefly to Bachelor Party, I mean, this is a long gone memory, but I think the reason why I walked out wasn't to do with the misogyny, but to do with animal abuse. I've got a memory of an animal being abused for comedy, and I found it,
yeah,
I found it really, yep. you know, really kind of abhorrent, and I walked out.
Yeah, I think there was definitely an animal, like a donkey mule or something that showed up
yeah.
at the bachelor party.
And they yeah. and something humiliating happens to the donkey, and that was the that was the last straw.
That was it.
Yeah.
And then finally, the last question is not so much a question. Well, I guess it is a question. But what is John Ronson's movie ritual like? Do you sit in kind of the same area? Do you have a concession stand ritual?
Oh, I like to go on my own to films. I always sit on the aisle. And I always sit very close to the front. So actually, like, front row aisle. In part because it's less likely that anyone's going to sit next to me.
Okay.
Yeah, so front row aisle. Yeah, especially when my son was kind of young. In fact, I had like this kind of, like a Tuesday night or Wednesday night, I would go off by myself to see a film. And it was like a night where I could sort of just be on my own for a little while.
Yeah.
Away from the stresses of being a young parent. But I still do it. Like, I still go down to, I've got, you know, I live in the Upper West Side of New York. So there's three or four really good cinemas sort of close to me. There's Lincoln Square, which is a really good independent cinema. Then there's a couple of really good multiplexes. And so there's always a whole bunch of good movies. Front row aisle. Concession stand, I don't really do that. But the rest of it I do.
Well, you've just given yourself away. So in New York City, yeah. Look for John Ronson on the aisle front row.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, John. Everyone go out and watch Okja on Netflix.
Yes.
And check out your Audible series. What's that called again?
It's called The Butterfly Effect, and it launches imminently. In fact, it's probably already launched by the time you put this up.
It will be, for sure.
Okay. It's a 7-part series on Audible. We'll be making it for about a year and a half. Those are my two newest things, Okja and The Butterfly Effect.
All right. Well, it's good talking to you, buddy.
And you.
Go get some sleep.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck.
Well, what a delight that was. Boy, John Ronson, I love that guy. I just want to hug him every time I see him. He's just such a sweet guy. He's a very kind, considerate human being. Every time I've hung out with the dude, he just has a lot to say about a lot of interesting things. Just a really great conversationalist. And I respect his work, value his opinion. So it's really neat to talk to him about Let the Right One In. This one, as you could tell, he kind of got a little deep here with why this was his favorite movie. And I thought this was really kind of neat. This was not nostalgia. This was not just purely love of the craft and art of this film. But this one kind of hit home for John in a very personal way from his own childhood and how he wishes that he had an Ellie of his own when he was a kid growing up there in Cardiff, Wales. So very personal story from John. Got some great insight into things I didn't know about the movie that he knew. It's kind of neat. Had spoken with the director before and had a great little story about Edgar Wright there. That was a delight. So it was just all around fantastic to have John in here to talk about Let the Right One In. Thanks for listening to Movie Crush this week. So until next week, keep your feet off the back of my seat for the love of God. Thanks for listening to Movie Crush. Have a great week. Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.